The bill that we're referring to is the Surveillance Legislation Amendment Identify and Disrupt Bill 2020, which passed both the House and the Senate last Wednesday and is now Australian law. It introduces three powers into the Australian law enforcement space in relation to electronic communication surveillance. And the three powers are a data disruption warrant, which authorises offensive data disruption powers and capabilities to disrupt the commission of offence using a computer. It enables the law enforcement agencies to disrupt data by modifying, adding, copying or deleting in order to frustrate the commission of serious offences online. The second power is the network activity warrant, which allows the law enforcement agencies in Australia to monitor computer-related activities of a criminal group for the purpose of collecting intelligence. And it's important the definition of criminal group is defined extremely broadly and means effectively an electronically grouped collection of individuals of two or more people using the same electronic service, which can include a website. The third power that's been introduced is account takeover warrant, which authorises law enforcement to assume control of an online account that's suspected of being used in the commission of an offence. It's punishable by up to 3 years imprisonment. So it's a very, very low threshold for each of these. That is, anything that has a maximum period of imprisonment of 3 years or more for an offence of a federal nature on the basis of reasonable suspicion, which is a very, very low bar to meet. And each of these warrants can be sought retroactively, so after investigations have already been undertaken.
That's very interesting. One thing that just occurs to me is that because of recent changes or relatively recent changes, anybody who is put in prison for a term over a year can be and come from another background can be extradited.
That's correct, yeah. Part of my professional practice as a partner of Irish Bentley Lawyers has been heavily involved in migration decision reviews, and the power you're talking about there is the Section 501 Migration Act power, which allows the minister to cancel a permanent or temporary visa of a person who is convicted of an offence of 12 years imprisonment or more, and that's regardless of whether the period of imprisonment is wholly suspended or time actually served.
Yeah, pretty crazy stuff. Before we go on to the actual meanings of some of these warrants and their application perhaps to activist groups, there's a couple of things that jump out at me. One is that the warrants can be given out by the Administrative Appeals Tribunal, and it's been pointed out by Mels that this particular tribunal is actually part of government rather than the judiciary, and we've been seeing a considerable level of stacking of these, this kind of tribunal, with people with particular political orientation. That's true, isn't it?
I mean, no disrespect to the Administrative Appeals Tribunal, and I say this and I hold the integrity of the Administrative Appeals Tribunal in high regard, but it is correct to say that the Administrative Appeals Tribunal is not a Chapter 3 court. So it's not a court in the sense that the Supreme Courts of each state and territories are a court, or the Federal Court or the High Court are courts established by the Constitution. There were some changes made to the Identify and Disrupt legislation before it passed Parliament, which do increase the judicial scrutiny of the warrants when they're issued. But there is a long history with this Home Affairs portfolio introducing bills and seeking to have bills passed that have a very, very low threshold for the issue of warrants. If we take a little walk through history, Annie, the first example of this is metadata retention, which was a bill introduced in 2013, passed in 2015, that allows warrantless access to metadata that's required to be retained by carriage service providers for 2 years, other than where the information relates to journalists and the journalist information warrants required. And unfortunately, we've seen plenty of examples where the Australian Federal Police have purportedly and inadvertently lapsed to seek warrants before accessing journalist information. The second tranche of this kind of legislation was found in the Assistance and Access legislation, which is the Technical Assistance Notices, Technical Requests and Technical Capability Notices, which effectively allow side doors into the very widely defined ambit of designated communications providers, which is a new term introduced into the Telecommunications Interception and Access Act 1997. Those requests and notices are issued via either very senior people within law enforcement or the Administrative Appeals Tribunal. And now the Identify and Disrupt Bill, as it was, had similar provisions that it was effectively senior law enforcement or the AAT that would be issuing these forms of surveillance techniques. And it is concerning that if you take a look through the last 60-odd appointments in the Administrative Appeals Tribunal, there is a common theme of the background of those people being connected directly or indirectly with the current government.
The other thing that is really interesting to me is this business of or another person on the law enforcement officer's behalf, so that the Australian Federal Police or the ACIC can outsource the work to a private company.
Yeah, there's a lot in this legislation about assistance given to law enforcement in the execution of these powers. And there's quite serious penalties of up to 10 years in prison for a person who fails to provide that assistance or discloses the existence of the assistance being provided to law enforcement. I have a deep concern that this is the delegability of the legislation makes law enforcement easier and further reduces the scrutiny and control over the legislation. These are extreme powers that have been introduced into Australian law and should only be used for extreme purposes under extreme scrutiny. And unfortunately, that scrutiny and clearly defined purposes don't appear in the Act.
The next thing is the notion that they can add, copy, delete or alter files on a computer. And I mean, the ostensible reason for doing this is a good one, which is to stop a criminal action. However, Mels has put forward the idea that actually they could then go to court with information which has been altered.
That's inherently a problem with altering information, is you're altering evidence that's ultimately relied upon for a prosecution. I wouldn't say that that's a clear intention of the legislature to allow that to happen, but I think that there should be a great degree of concern about the controls and scrutiny and oversight of this legislation if there's a potential for that to happen. And there is a potential inherently attached to this because the power is now there. A criticism that I and others in submissions to the Parliamentary Joint Committee on Intelligence and Security, which reviewed this bill and made 33 recommendations, largely those recommendations weren't adopted before Parliament passed this legislation, was that there needs to be a federal enforceable human rights framework that serves as a check and balance against the way this power is used and the potential abuses of this power. And there's been plenty of international law created around secret courts and the way that secret warrants are issued and the way that covert surveillance operations occur. Because when things are occurring in the shadows, inherently they're not capable of the same level of scrutiny as things that happen in plain sight.
Yeah, well, because logically speaking, that any system that is built on assumed trustworthiness of the operatives is a ludicrous arrangement.
Yes. Well, it's basically we should have this power because you should trust us.
Yeah.
And the problem with that is trust is something that's hard-earned and easily lost. And I would respectfully say that this government has been a shining example of how trust in relation to how electronic systems are used by a government is lost. And I think it's unrealistic to expect the Australian community to simply trust the government will use this responsibly in that context. And I think that that trust is under additional strain by the way in which these kind of powers, particularly the identify and disrupt powers, are introduced and then rushed through the process of passage without a great deal of public debate and scrutiny. And this particular piece of legislation was introduced in December last year under a mandate from the Minister for Home Affairs that it would be immediately referred to the Parliamentary Joint Committee on Intelligence and Security that would urgently report on the legislation so that it could pass in the August 2021 sittings of Parliament. And that's exactly what's happened. And that warrants scrutiny in itself, the way that the Minister for Home Affairs is choosing to introduce and have passed legislation, particularly legislation that has such a potential for dramatic impacts on Australians' lives.
Now, there's a very important aspect to this for people who are activists, anti-mining and climate action groups, groups that have targeted Pine Gap, and also animal rights activists. These are people who are c could fall under and probably are part of, are being characterized as criminal networks and related to substantial loss or damage to critical infrastructure or property based on the fact that there's a federal aspect within the law that's being passed.
It's a completely reasonable concern, and it's a concern that I, on behalf of the Queensland Council of Civil Liberties and Electronic Frontiers Australia, and a colleague for the Australian Privacy Foundation and Liberty Victoria, made in our submission to the Parliamentary Joint Committee, that the intention of the legislation and the legislation as it's actually drafted are not aligned in relation to where it could be used. This was introduced under the auspices of stopping terrorism and child exploitation, human trafficking. But the scope of this is significantly wider. And I think the concern that's held by activists is a real concern. And there's been examples very recently with respect to the Pegasus operation, which was a iOS zero-click exploit that was used by law enforcement from 2016 that effectively has been used to monitor and then subsequently prosecute and jail activists across the world.
And the jail terms are not short.
No, there's significant punishments that sit around this, which again is a way of concealing what government's doing rather than bringing it into light. And I understand that there is a reason for national security to be done in part without there being a transparent disclosure of what's happening. But the checks and balances for this kind of power certainly should be something that, if it's good enough for Australia, it should be open and viewable for all Australians. And Australians should have been made a lot more aware of this than they had been before this passed.
It's kind of interesting because if you look back to something like what's at stake in, say, the Bernard Collaery case, which was related to using our spy network to spy on East Timorese over a oil exploitation contract, really on behalf of Woodside, as opposed to the Australian national interest. It's changing the nature of our democracy using public tools to suppress action, against our rights, this kind of law.
It is, and it's concerning in the Australian context, Danny, because we don't have a federal enforceable human rights framework like all other Western democracies do. So we are at a disadvantage when we look towards our colleagues in the United States, Canada, the UK, or New Zealand. And it's noteworthy that each of those countries are also Five Eye agreement countries, and Australia is what I would describe as the weak link in the arrangement between those Western democratic societies.
Is it a lack of appreciation of the need for a de democratic society, or is it sort of a feeble understanding of your role as a government, your public duty that's being exposed here, do you think?
In what sense, sorry, Annie?
Well, in the sense that they see the government sees a specific aim. It creates specific legislation. It gets its legal teams to create the legislation and put it forward. Then they push it through without any discussion, and which is a very foolish thing to do anyway, because any thing that is significant of this sort needs to be chewed over for potential consequences that you didn't expect. But we've got a government that insists, like almost like a baby on it with a tantrum, that this must be the way it's done. And so I'm wondering, is it about their competency, or is it that they're completely ideologically driven, in your view? Or is that going too far in this conversation for you to be able
No,
to comment?
in my view, we've reached a dangerous point in Australia, which is we don't have the protections of a human rights framework as a safeguard, and we have law enforcement agencies that are stuck in a cycle of control. But these pieces of legislation, if you map from 2013 with the introduction of the metadata retention to date, the level of power that's being conferred upon law enforcement and the rapid acquisition of that power warrants a lot of concern and criticism in the first instance. And I think that's an unfortunate situation where these powers exist to justify the existence of these powers, which requires more power. And we should be taking the opposite path. In my view, power should inherently be difficult, not easy. And all we're doing is making power easier and easier and easier. And that makes it easier and easier and easier to misuse or potentially abuse that power. And that's a dangerous, dangerous place to be without the context of an enforceable human rights framework as at least some part of judicial safeguard.
And I guess the steps that most people should be focusing on is getting that infrastructure of human rights within our system.
I think if there's something that Australians can do is to demand a human rights framework be introduced by the government that is elected at the next federal election, and to pass that legislation with a requirement that each of these surveillance powers and a lot of what's been introduced by the Home Affairs portfolio over the past 8 years or so be subject to scrutiny under that Act before any further use of those powers.